Good morning. Nice to see you all. Keeping each other warm in here. Here's a poem. And you let me know if you can hear me back there and over here and over here. Okay? We look with uncertainty beyond the old choices for clear-cut, for clear-cut answers to a softer, more permeable aliveness, which is every moment at the brink of death. For something new is being born in us, if we but let it. We stand at a new doorway, awaiting that which comes, daring to be human creatures, vulnerable to the beauty of existence, learning to love. Excuse me, my voice isn't so strong today. Would you like to hear it again? Might be stronger the second time. We look with uncertainty beyond the old choices for clear-cut answers to a softer, more permeable aliveness, which is every moment at the brink of death. For something new is being born in us, if we but let it. We stand at a new doorway, awaiting that which comes, daring to be human creatures, vulnerable to the beauty of existence, learning to love. And I'm sorry to say, I don't know who wrote this. I found it in my collection. I have a collection of poems. Some people collect stamps, I collect poems. But I don't have the author of it. So, welcome to everyone, and I mean everyone. Everyone, all are welcome here. And if you look around, you might see that we're fairly homogeneous. We are not a very diverse group, and we would like to be more diverse, but we are certainly welcoming, working on being welcoming to all. And that means however you identify religiously, politically, by gender, race, ethnicity, however we want to extend just a warm welcome so that this will be a refuge for you. So taking refuge is a big deal in Zen and in Buddhism, and I hope that today that you will feel that this is a refuge for you. And refuge in Buddhism is definitely a refuge from the chaos of the world and from hatred and ill will, but it also has a quality of challenge to it, because we take refuge in non-delusion, non-denial. So we look directly at those things. So it's a little bit different idea of refuge. And so our purpose here is to wake up from delusion and suffering caused by delusion and experience our innate clarity and kindness. So that's refuge. So we look at what gets in the way of generosity and kindness and clarity and compassion and wisdom. So it's pretty simple. It's a simple practice. But there are lots of teachings about the practice. And if you keep coming, you will absorb some of those little by little. So today my topic is giving non-fear. You probably see that if you have a program. I hope we have enough programs, because when it's time to sing together at the end, you'll need that. There, I warned you. I know some of you really hate singing, but you know, life is suffering sometimes. You just have to deal. So I think that there's a lot of feelings circulating amongst people right now. I know there is. We all know that. And some of the things that I'm hearing from people are fear and fear, anger, rage, despair, resignation, and also conviction and hope and courage. So a full range of emotions, but a lot of scary emotions. And in Buddhism, we like to privilege equanimity. You know, equanimity needs to be part of our practice. It needs to be part of cultivating all of the divine abodes of loving kindness, compassion, and sympathetic joy. Equanimity is key. But I think feelings are important, and that we should feel our feelings. We should sit with them. We can hold them. We can journal on them. We can share them with friends and with Sangha members. And I think it's important to be open to them and not to shut down. So people in marginalized groups in this country, those people who don't have the privilege of being white or heterosexual or male, sorry to say that, a lot of people are feeling fear right now. And some of their trauma is being triggered. People have trauma from difficult experiences growing up, experiences of violence, experiences of poverty, of lack of opportunity. And so we should be aware of that. You know, we can be aware of that without shying away from that. And we can aspire to offer non-fear. Non-fear. Non-fear was considered by the Buddha to be a really key form of generosity. You know, and you'll see statues of Buddha and also some of Jizo Bodhisattva with the hand, the upraised hand. That's the gesture of have no fear. So we should all cultivate the inner gesture. I invite you to, no shoulds, I invite you to cultivate the inner gesture of non-fear in order to offer that out there, offer that to this world, which is really crying for that right now. So, and you know, we also have to offer that to ourselves. We have to offer that to ourselves first, right? It's by being in touch with the fact that we are feeling some fear, we are feeling some anxiety, being aware of that, sitting with that. Our practice is excellent for that, you know, sitting with whatever comes up. And sometimes that's fear. Okay. So, I think I got my papers kind of mixed up here. That's happened before. So, the other day in our priest, all-priest meeting, we have these all-priest meetings with our colleagues here, and Tim convened us and asked us to think about and talk about what we think of as engaged Buddhism. And so for my part, I just talked a little bit about how I use the three tenets of the peacemaker order, which are not knowing, bearing witness, and compassionate action. And I also fall back on and check in with the three pure precepts. So pure is purely simple. Do no harm, practice good, and practice good for others. So pretty simple, right? Pretty simple. But kind of helpful, you know, pretty helpful to have some kind of guideline. And applying not knowing to these precepts, applying not knowing is humbling, and it's protective for me, you know, so I don't get caught up in the danger of the helper, the one who's going to help or fix people. That's always a danger when you work in a field that is a caregiving field. I work, besides working with folks here as a spiritual caregiver at a healthcare organization, and so that sense of inflatedness and self-delusion that comes with being a helper sometimes is balanced by this not knowing. It's balanced by that. And so I want to take that into everything I do, and I've been exploring a little bit with a group here about how I could be more socially active. And that not knowing is really helpful to me, because there's a lot we can't see. There's a lot we're not aware of. And yet we fall back often on this sense of, I know. I've learned a lot in my life, and there's a lot I know, and let me tell you all about it. Right? That's, the older we get, the more ingrained that is, I think. So that not knowing principle is helpful. And I'm learning. And sometimes that feels really awkward. You know, you stretch yourself when you're learning, and sometimes you stretch yourself a little bit and it feels kind of uncomfortable, right? Or it's embarrassing how much you don't know. So it's embarrassing and it's a little uncomfortable at times, but I think it's a good thing, you know. I think it helps me, and I think it's keeping me, it's helped me to live more by my my values. So, this generosity, this non-fear, giving non-fear, I think the person that that stays calm in a crisis, that you know, when a tornado hits or an earthquake, the one person in the room who stays calm and doesn't run screaming can be a very powerful force for good, for everybody. And that's, and we can feel, when we hear about these examples, we feel this moved by them, our eyes fill a little bit. We get this swell of pride in the goodness of humanity when we hear about what people are capable of in a big crisis. But then there's small ways too, everyday ways that we can cultivate this non-fear, and it starts with awareness. And so an example I have that I'll share with you is that I've struggled with is being confronted by the scary person. I call them the scary person. That's the person that I meet on the street, who's disheveled and dirty and maybe ranting, and then I feel the fear rise up. I feel it. And then immediately the avoidance, you know, I want to get away. I want to get away from the scary person. And I don't want to engage with them. And so what I'd like to posit here is that just my being aware of that and feeling that and reflecting on that, on how that works and how what my response is a form of practice. It's becoming aware of what conditions cause us to contract and to turn away and to feel flooded with fear. So this is good. It's not fun necessarily, but it's practice. It's practice. It's good. So one thing that we can do when we are working in this way is to confess it to others that you know you feel kind of badly. I feel badly about that, you know, about that avoidance, which isn't in line with my values. But at the same time, that's I have to work with where I'm at. I have to have a little compassion for myself in that situation and tell someone else. So I'm really lucky I can tell all of you today about that. So the fear of the other. Who is the other to us? We can think about that. Who is the other? Who is the scary person? And what have you done? How have you worked with the scary person or the difficult person at work or even in your family? You know, much less someone on the street, but sometimes we have a scary person in our own lives, you know. What ways have you worked with the scary person, with yourself, with the scary person, too? And how has that changed something for you? How has that transformed something? So we have the examples in our tradition of the Bodhisattvas. Last week, Ben gave a wonderful talk where he talked about one of our modern-day bodhisattvas. You could even call him a saint, Martin Luther King, because saints are often killed, and he was killed. And Martin Luther King's number of his quotes really make me wonder whether he had actually studied Buddhism, because they're so in line with some of our quotes, even from the Dhammapada. Let's see, which one? Oh, like this one. Darkness cannot drive out darkness, only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate, only love can do that. And this other one, I've decided to stick with love. Hate is too great a burden to bear. Yes, it is. Hate causes suffering. Chiefly to us. So they echo the sayings of the Buddha and other great teachers. And most of us can't imagine being willing to die for principles such as nonviolence. But I think we can think about how we can be a little braver, you know, just have a little bit more courage in day-to-day life to address injustice, to address suffering. I think we can do that. I want to do that. I plan to do that. Just step by step, you know, baby step by baby step. I think we can. I plan to join with in coalitions with people of other faiths and other traditions. And the Women's March was just a wonderful symbolic start for that activity for me. I feel very fortunate that I was able to both participate in the Women's March, because I do know people who weren't able to do that, and sometimes I have to help them a little with, give them a little hope, which I received from being part of that really lovely gathering. Yeah, it was a great start. It was a wonderful symbolic start. I know people who were worried that it was going to be focusing on the negative, and that it was going to be, the focus was going to be entirely on our new president in a negative way, but it really wasn't that at all. I felt it was very positive, very uplifting, and really a good start to this new year. And then the other thing that I was able to do was to participate in a vigil, a meditation vigil on Inauguration Day. So I was really lucky that way too. In the vigil, a friend of mine, Caius Vian, led us through a number of guided meditations. You know, and basically they were just helping us move a little bit closer, just a little bit closer to acceptance of what is, basically. And that was hard for us, but we did that together, and it felt really wonderful, and I was able to grieve. I was able to grieve. Feel my feelings, and that's very cleansing, which is really helpful. So I want to mention another inspiring modern-day bodhisattva here, Rachel Carson. Have some of you heard of Rachel Carson? Most of you, maybe. She wrote a seminal book in 1962 called Silent Spring, where she talks of, she basically in that book talks about the dangers of DDT, which at the time was being sprayed pretty indiscriminately, and she'd done the research, and this book that she wrote became the rallying cry for the environmental movement eventually. She, you know, didn't preach love and nonviolence, but she preached love of an interconnected, interrelated natural world. And she also was pretty clear when she was interviewed in 1965 in a documentary that she knew that her voice was prophetic, and she knew that she had, you know, the power and the influence to help change people's minds. And one of the things she said is that we just have to mature as human beings and to realize that we need to be mindful of how what we're doing affects the environment. She died in 65 of breast cancer. And, you know, she wanted to get a PhD. She wasn't able to do that because she took care of, unlike Martin Luther King, who was born into the Brahmin caste of African Americans in Atlanta, and was nurtured to be this great moral leader from the time he was a young child. She had a little bit more of a struggle in life because her dad died, and she had to take care of her mother and two orphan cousins. In spite of all that, she got a job with the U.S. Wildlife and Fisheries. She took care of her family and wrote books on the side, some of which became bestsellers on the New York Times bestseller list. So she's, you know, someone I recommend biographies about her, and there's a new documentary on PBS. I haven't seen it because I don't have TV. But if you have TV and you have Channel 2, you might find it inspiring. It has a different kind of contemporary bodhisattva. So, let's see. Where am I here? Okay. Bodhisattvas. Bodhisattvas, what they do for us is inspire us. They inspire us to take some little steps. So another way that we can start to to work with non-fear is to, when we sit, we can devote ourselves to uncovering our fears. And I want to share with you this verse from a koan case that I've shared before with you, but you probably don't remember. I hope you don't remember, and it sounds new. And it goes like this, the verse, "The cave of the blue dragon is ominous. Only the fearless dare to enter. It is here that the forest of patterns is clearly revealed. It is here that the one ripe pearl is hidden." So the one bright pearl is our awakened nature, our enlightenment, our Buddha nature. And it's, where is it hidden? It's hidden in the cave of the blue dragon, the place where the monster under the bed is kept. That existential fear that we have that sort of runs through our consciousness like a little stream bubbling up now and then. We get in touch with that with sitting and with retreat practice. We enter the cave of the blue dragon and sit with what's in that cave. And it's through that that the one bright pearl can shine in us, the awakened way, the awakened mind. That's really true. So this process of Zazen, according to Daidu Lori, engages that fear in order to empower fearlessness, which does not mean a lack of fear. It means experiencing our fear and then moving forward. So, and it's processing it. It's processing it. So Ben talked last week about to study the self in Zen is to forget the self, according to Dogen. When we forget the self, our fear drops away and we become approachable by others, by all beings can then approach us. And here's what Bhikkhu Bodhi says. Bhikkhu Bodhi is this respected Western Theravadan teacher about what we can do as communities, Buddhist communities. He says, "We can call in unison for a policy of global generosity in place of rash militarism, for programs that protect the poor and vulnerable, for the advancement of social and racial justice, and for the rapid transition to a clean energy economy. To stand up and speak out in support of such ends is not necessarily to meddle in party politics. It's rather to bring the moral weight of the Dharma to bear on matters that affect the lives of people everywhere, now and long into the future." So I was happy to hear this from him, because I worry sometimes that it's important for us as an organization to be open and welcoming to everyone, including people who don't agree with us, you know, and that we certainly can't sit up here as Zen teachers and espouse a particular party over another. But what he's saying is compassion, basically, kindness, speaking out in support of others who are vulnerable. So I know you're, let's look at the time. Okay, we still have a few minutes, and I was a little bit nervous about giving this talk. I thought, oh, wow, there's a lot happening. It's a big responsibility, so I better have lots and lots of stuff. So, you know, that's how it goes. Sometimes when you feel that little bit of nervousness or anxiety about these talks. So on the way to becoming a budding, compassionate activist, or just a woke human being, I have some suggestions to offer you that I've been working with for, well, I guess it's about 6 decades now. So number one, take care of yourself along the way to this woke state, to this budding activism. Celebrate, do art or music or dance, write, meditate, seek out inspiration, do these things with others and alone. The signs at the women's retreat were very creative and fun, and there were only a few mean ones. Most of them were really sweet. You can offer non-fear to your friends and vulnerable others by your example of faith in the goodness of the majority of people, in their goodness and in your own. You can share your equanimity, your wisdom and compassion developed on the cushion, developed inside the Blue Dragon Cave, of your retreat practice and your personal therapy, and with people outside your community of privilege. You can plant and water the seeds of kindness, joy, equanimity, and compassion in your mind stream, protect and cultivate that consciousness while opening to others who are temporarily frozen in fear or confusion, and bear witness to that fear and confusion. You can open yourself to the views of folks who are unlike you, seek them out and listen to them. They are family members, co-workers, rural people, inner city people, suburban people. What are their worries and concerns? You can see the harmful actions of some in power without blinders on, seeing their actions for what they are, while continuing to expect goodwill in the majority of people. Expect goodwill. You can practice seeing the enemy as your greatest teacher. How have you worked with that before? How has that been transformative? You can practice with seeing how enemy images arise in the mind and how they function in your heart and mind, how they make you feel physically, emotionally, spiritually. And we can take good care of this place, of our own place. This place, our place, what's right in front of us, what's right under our feet. We can help each other, and we can mirror these abilities for each other. We can shore each other up when one of us gets caught in despair, that the failures that we experience along the way inevitably bring up can help each other. We're reading this book. This is an uprising here, a few of us, and one thing that I really found encouraging about that was this research that was done showing that it takes only 3.5% of the total population to be active in order to affect enough change for a tipping point, and has examples, and that was very encouraging to me, very, very encouraging. And one of the things that I do to cultivate joy in myself when I'm not thinking about really deep and serious subjects like this today is to sing. Now we're getting to that part that some of you dread. Can I borrow your program? You can look on with him. So I have joined this choir. So today I was thinking, oh, I'm really going to be preaching to the choir at this this talk. And so that's pretty easy, right? But anyway, I'm in this choir, and it's a comfort choir. So we sing for people, anyone who requests us to sing for them. If they're in some distress, maybe they're in a nursing home or a hospital, or maybe they're just going through something, and this group responds to that. And so it's rekindled my joy in singing, which was cultivated when I was young. And the songs that we sing are generally songs of comfort and very uplifting. So it's a great joy. And I'm not a great singer, but I can carry a tune, which I think is important if you're in a choir, to be able to carry a tune. It's helpful. Not completely necessary, but helpful. So this song I'd like to share with you. And then I'm wondering if you would sing it with me. Some of you will do that, I know, and others can just kind of go, Those of you who don't like singing, okay? So I'll sing it first. This is called Sanctuary. It's actually a repurposed Christian song that our choir has changed a few of the words. So, but the tune is the same. So it goes like this. Life, prepare me to be a sanctuary, clear and holy, tried and true. With thanksgiving, I'll be a living sanctuary for you. So that's how it goes, and we could sing this together. Would you like to? Do you need? Okay. So do you need to have it lined out?
No fear.
Okay. We're gonna sing it twice. Life, prepare me to be a sanctuary, clear and holy, tried and true. With thanksgiving, I'll be a living sanctuary for you. One more time. Life, prepare me to be a sanctuary, clear and holy, tried and true. With thanksgiving, I'll be a living sanctuary for you. Good job. Good job. So that's it today. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. And if you'd like to share a comment or question? Yes.
Yeah, question, comment. So I'm curious. Delusions are in the gospel. How it's one thing to seek someone out who doesn't. Open to the devil, who are very single-minded, and listening to them is—I understand that, and giving them the space to talk. But how do you practice containing anger? For me, I think it's important to give people a voice, and I'm angry when people shout in protest past people who feel left out, and it goes both ways.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the level of public discourse has become very, very difficult.
Yeah. And so how would you suggest, I know you gave suggestions on working with people who aren't like-minded, right? How can you give a little more advice to that end? Or
you know, I'm fairly privileged. I'm not interacting with a lot of people who are shouting me down or arguing with me in that way. And I think even I realize with my suggestion to talk to people who are different, first it's overcoming your fear of doing that, and then And then it's, well, where do you find those people, you know? Where do you find them? That's not always easy for some of us, you know? I mean, how will we start, you know? I have more questions than I have answers for you about that. I don't think we should listen calmly and compassionately to people who are screaming at us, but I don't think we should engage in what they're doing either, you know, get stirred up and respond in kind.
I have had people say to my face, I don't understand why you think this is a bad thing going on right now. Mm-hmm. Like, whoa, okay.
Yeah, so you're right. You're in a field, or you're in a day-to-day situation where you are actually coming into contact with that, and that's a real intense place of practice. And it's easy to talk about, you know, do this, try that, but to be in that situation is something else again. All I can say is, if you practice, you practice. Don't neglect your practice to be an activist. You have to start with the practice, you know, of calming the self, you know, entering into conversations in a place of calm, you know, with an intention that you set, you know, hopefully before you go into it, even visualizing the situation. That's why I asked you if people could share an example of what you've done in a situation that was really tense like that, that you did within yourself that became transformative, then that helps everybody else. Yeah, Lily.
So I'm in a class with someone right now who very clearly has opposing views to my own and wears politically oriented t-shirts and so forth, and it's very obvious what the person's outtake is on the current situation for it. But before I realized that, we started getting involved in a conversation and regarding the wall, the building of the wall, and I started, you know, to sense, oh wait, you know, this is somebody who is not on the same side of the wall as I am. And, you know, you can't control people or their opinions. Sometimes you can bring a view to the table, but that's all you can do. Whether or not they're open to it is their decision. And I could see that this person was really kind of dug in their position. So for my own sanity, I just chose to say, you know what, I think we're on opposite sides of the fence here, so I'll just...
We should talk about, you know.
Yeah. Ellie?
Yes.
Thank you.
This is actually the work that I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, to answer your question about, you know, I got this person who's really getting me very upset. My suggestion is two things. One is, be honest with them and tell them I care about you. I mean, as Buddhists, we're all taught we need to care for other people. And I think just saying that, even if it's somebody who's angry with, I care about you, that's going to get them somewhere away from where they were. Just, I mean, even a micrometer. But more importantly, I think that all of us need to get to the place where we're talking about our commonalities. You know, that, you know, the refugees, they want the same thing as the people who want to keep them out. I mean, we all want our children to succeed. We all want to be free of violence. It's physical and emotional. We all want 20 minutes of peace. And all of us want to love and be loved. And if you can talk about even one, if not all four of those commonalities, then it's not going to affect, I mean, we're not going to break every wall, okay? But we have to get beyond them and us. We are not going to make it if all we're doing is digging trenches deeper and deeper on either side of the wall. And I think us us as Buddhists, even though it is painful, and of course we have to take care of ourselves. But remember, our job is about ending suffering. That is what our mission is, and it's active. Mm-hmm. It's not passive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we can do it. Use your imagination, but I think the most important thing is I care about you as a human.
Can you hear that? What Ellie's saying? Yeah, excellent. Thank you so much. It's beautiful. And you know what? We don't have too much more time. Was there a quick final thing? Someone? Yeah. Carrie.
So I just wanted to comment on the scary person. And as a woman, multi-ethnic, but perceived as white, the scary person has come up a lot, and that awareness, I think, is really important. And having experienced trauma at the hands of a man, noticing that too, that awareness, and it is there is also a safety mechanism built in, that scary person. There's a reason I'm becoming fearful and wanting to move away at the same time.
Sure.
That, being open to that awareness, being open to that acceptance, and then responding, taking action from that place,
Yeah, and having compassion for yourself in that. Yep. Thank you. Thanks, everyone, so much for your comments and good contributions.